This is Backstory with us, the American History Guys. I'm Peter Onuf, the 18th century guy.
I'm Ed Ayers, the 19th century guy.
And I'm Brian Ballow, 20th century history guy. A few weeks ago, a historian friend of ours here at the University of Virginia, a guy by the name of Gary Gallagher, received an invitation to deliver a talk about the Civil War. Now, there's nothing new about that. Gary's one of the most prominent scholars on the Civil War. He could probably talk about the Civil War in his sleep. But he had the feeling that this lecture was going to be just a little bit different.
I was asked to talk to basically the Democratic caucus of the United States Senate.
The invitation came from the office of Senator Harry Reid. They wanted Gary to provide the after-dinner entertainment for a group of 49 senators attending a retreat in Central Virginia.
I'd been told to give 20 minutes worth of comments and to be ready for 20 minutes worth of questions and answers. And the third and most important thing, according to the person who invited me and who was speaking for the majority leader, Senator Reid, don't be boring.
That last admonition weighed on Gary throughout the evening's dinner, especially as the dinner went on and on and on, much later into the evening than had been originally planned.
Just before I got up, Senator Kerry, who was sitting right across from me, leaned over and said, I wouldn't give prepared remarks if I were you. And I said, I'm way ahead of you, Senator. I'm not giving prepared remarks. And so I didn't. I asked for a handheld mic, and I just walked up and down and talked to them.
Gary ended up talking to the senators about everything, from the balance of power between federal, state, and local governments to what happens to individual liberties in wartime, all from the perspective of the mid-19th century. The Q&A continued late into the evening, leading Gary to believe that a lot of these senators found the Civil War more than a little relevant to the issues they're dealing with today.
In the spirit of that evening, we're devoting today's show to your questions about the Civil War, interested in hearing your thoughts about how the war connects with today. The last two episodes of our program look specifically at the run-up to the war and the question of what actually motivated Northerners and Southerners to take up arms against each other. In this third episode of our Civil War 150th Anniversary series, we're opening things up. All questions are fair game. And yes, we promise to do our utmost not to be boring.
Okay, guys. I understand that we all get excited about anniversaries, and it's been 150 years since the Civil War. But I got to tell you, I don't understand all of the effort and the subtlety and the nuance that is gone into recreating this event. It actually seems pretty clear cut to me, right? I mean, there are two really fundamental things at stake. One is the preservation of the Union,
yeah.
And two is liberty,
and
right?
Liberty for
check,
all. Yeah.
Check,
uh-huh.
Check,
right.
End of story.
Yeah, well,
I mean, what actually is there to talk about?
Well, Brian, I would say the question then and now is this: who is an American? Now, if you think we have a clear answer to that question right now, then I think you're crazy, and you know that it's not true. We're constantly debating the margins of nationhood. Well, that's what was happening in the period of the Civil War.
Yeah.
That is, were African Americans really part of America? Were they Americans? Now, that's the question I think that's so troubling to us now looking back, is even in the North, the civil rights, the liberties of blacks were radically circumscribed, you would have very few people accept fully the notion that these are us, that is, white people saying black people are part of the great American people. And obviously slavery was the great bulwark of this exclusion of a whole people, but that's the reality of the time. So let's look it straight in the face and say, okay, yeah, we have come a long way, but it wasn't because we got rid of Confederates. I mean, that wasn't it.
Yeah.
There was a lot of other things that had to happen.
So you're pointing to a danger also, Peter, which is the notion that, okay, this is an important question, but we settled it in the Civil War.
Exactly right.
And not really settled it, but atoned for it.
And atoned for it. Yeah, that's terrific. Yeah,
that's what gets me, is a sense of, yes, I know we were all complicit in this for 200 years, longer than we've been since the Civil War, that the nation as a whole tolerated and fostered slavery. And somehow that the white North sacrifice, intentional or otherwise, in the Civil War, somehow wipes the books clean and buys innocence for the nation. I think the other danger of it is that it creates the impression that a war can fix a deep-seated social problem.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, look, in just 4 years, the North wiped out slavery. Imagine what we could do elsewhere with missiles and tanks. So I think that it's full of danger to too easily settle upon a triumphal story of the Civil War. I think it's better for us to feel so profoundly fortunate that it turned out as it did, and for us to redeem that good fortune by trying to live up to the best of its promise.
Guys, we have some good fortune of our own. We call that good fortune our listeners and our callers. For the past few weeks, our producers have been soliciting your questions on our website, backstoryradio.org. Today, they've invited a few of the people who left comments there to join us on the phone.
Our first call today is from Atlanta, Georgia. It's Dan. Dan, welcome to Backstory.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So, Civil War, hot topic. Dan, what's on your mind?
Well, I was thinking a lot about the secession crisis of 1860 and 1861.
Right.
Because it seems to me, in many of the popular retellings of the history of the war, that it kind of goes that, you know, Lincoln was elected in November of 1860, and from then on, bam, the Civil War was happening, and there was no stopping it.
Right.
But over time, you know, I've kind of looked a little bit closer at some of the events that happened, and there was a really long time in between when Lincoln was elected and when the fighting really started. You know, the states, they didn't all leave at once. They kind of slowly filed out one at a time. And there was a lot of negotiations back and forth and a lot of debate in the state legislatures. And so with all of this going on, all of these different small events, how much did those affect the course of history as opposed to the longer-term events that we talk about a lot in
that's
history books,
that's a great,
like slavery and sectionalism?
Well, you know, Dan, you're really putting your finger on a hot button for historians. It's the contingency button. That is, things are not inevitable. Stuff happens, but it doesn't have to happen. And we have one of the world's leading authorities on contingency hailing from the 19th century. Come to us, Ed. Communications are very irregular across the centuries.
One way to think about this is there's two groups of historians. One are the fundamentalists who point to the real fact that slavery is a driving source of conflict from the moment that the American nation is created, and that the fact that we see every decade some different kind of struggle over it shows that it was going to come to some kind of head. And if you just want to get all hung up on the details of what actually happened, you're overlooking this fundamental struggle.
Right.
Other people say, No. This is really about the political machinations at the time. And this is what most American historians thought in the 1920s and 30s, that if you'd had somebody other than James Buchanan and other inept, blundering generation, as the famous phrase went, you would have had the war. I think what historians today are trying to figure out is exactly how do you connect those underlying structural tensions and the more, you know, dynamic, personal, and
contingent.
Says, contingent one, right?
But Ed, wouldn't you say that something had to happen? I'm prepared to say that as an expert on the founding, so you might cast me as a fundamentalist, but what's going to happen is by no means clear. Does it have to be that kind of war? Do we know who the antagonists are going to be? We don't know these outcomes, and it seems to me everything is wound up in the thing that does happen, and that, of course, is deeply contingent.
Well, you know, I think the critical thing to understand is that it's not just that the war has started like a wind-up toy.
Yeah,
even in April of 1861. Once it begins, it can follow lots of different courses. As a matter of fact, the one that it followed seemed very unlikely to most people at the time, that it could be fought to just ultimate exhaustion on both sides. You know, even after Virginia, Tennessee, North Carolina, and Arkansas leave, Maryland and Kentucky do not. Even though you could imagine that Kentucky had at least as much reason to secede as Tennessee, it didn't because of geopolitical positioning and so forth. So I think, you know, Dan, you're onto something really important, that we've got to relax our certainty of how the story is unfolding enough to actually see what happened.
I have a question for you, Dan. As 20th century guy, I want to know what interests you about all this stuff.
You know, frankly, to me, it seems a really long time ago.
He's from Atlanta, Brian.
That is true. Yeah, we've got a big reminder carved onto Stone Mountain.
That's right.
Of the conflict. You know, in Atlanta, there's historical markers on every corner in downtown Atlanta.
Yeah, but you know, you guys are too busy to hate there in Atlanta, and you've kind of, you know, you're the new South. But, you know, to get back to contingency, what about you? What about your circumstances really drives you to learn so much about the Civil War? You seem to know more about it than I do, for instance.
That is saying next to nothing.
I know. Dan doesn't know that, though. You didn't have to tell him that.
Go ahead, Dan.
Well, I think that part of what drives my interest in it today is that there is so much contemporary debate on it. Mm-hmm. So even if, you know, the Civil War in and of itself was not that interesting, the fact that so many people keep debating about what caused it, how did this happen, what does it mean, you know, it just kind of naturally drives my interest to look into some of the history around and say, well, you know, what did happen?
In other words, Dan, you're saying it's out of self-defense. That you engage with,
like
that. And I think
well,
you know, I
think
that's a serious response. I'm not making fun of that.
I would have a word in particular for Dan. We look back on it now and notice that Georgia came in pretty soon after South Carolina, was one of the original Confederate states. But historians have looked at the returns pretty carefully and think that maybe a majority of white Georgia men would have voted against secession if it had been presented as such. And it's certainly the case that Georgia, under Governor Brown, began to be a real thorn in the side of the Confederacy almost from the beginning, withholding men, resisting Confederate policy. Mm. So here's the contingent thing I'd leave you with, Dan. Virginia comes in kicking and screaming, deeply reluctant, and then is remarkably loyal to the Confederacy from start to finish. Whereas Georgia is torn apart. Northern Georgia resists the Confederacy. So we tend to think about the Deep South being the real Confederacy and the Upper South being kind of an ersatz Confederacy.
Yeah, yeah.
But in the course of the war, it becomes the opposite.
So, Dan, do you feel well-armed for your next engagement on the Civil War?
I hope so.
Good. We'll keep your powder dry.
It's difficult to make some progress against some people sometimes.
All right. Well, Dan, keep on fighting.
Thank you, Dan.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you very much.
Bye.
Bye, Dan.
This is Backstory, the show that looks at a topic from the perspective of three different centuries. I'm the 18th century guy, Peter Onuf.
I'm the 19th century guy, Ed Ayers.
And I'm the 20th century guy, Brian Ballow. Today, we're marking the 150th anniversary of the Civil War's beginnings by opening up the phone lines to your questions about the conflict. For a few weeks now, our producers have been surveying all the comments that you left at backstoryradio.org. Today, they've invited a few of the people who left questions there to join us on the phone.
Hey, guys. We got a call from New York City. Elaine's on the line. Elaine, welcome to Backstory.
Hi. Thank you so much, and thank you for having me on the show. So I was wondering what the racial and the ethnicity makeup was in the military in both North and South, since at that time there were a lot of different races and plus a lot of different ethnicities living in America already.
Right.
So I would imagine that the militaries probably had a good mixture of different races, probably in the North, but I'm not so sure about the South.
Ed, maybe you could speak in a general way to the ethnic and racial makeup of the armies. In a way, the question is, do they reflect the country or the parts of the country that are now at war with each other?
They actually do reflect their populations very effectively. The white Southern concern was that the Union armies were reflecting too much ethnic diversity, that they were not really the Northern people mobilizing, but rather sending what they saw as the riffraff and people who didn't have a job otherwise, sort of mercenaries. But we've looked at this pretty carefully, and it turns out that white Southerners were right in that Northern immigrants did fight, but they fought really as a part of solidarity often with other people from their own ethnicities, and they fought with remarkable bravery and consistency. The harder thing for us to understand, perhaps, is that also in the South, which was more ethnically diverse before the Civil War than it was afterwards.
Yeah, interesting.
That there sometimes people were more conflicted, but you would have had very prominent Irish people, mm-hmm. Germans, and Jews who would fight for the Confederacy. So I think the general story is that the entire populations of the North and South, the entire white populations, were quite mobilized by the Civil War.
And that's the important qualification, Elaine. It's
white
we're talking about. The idea of African Americans fighting on either side, though ultimately, of course, even the Confederates consider mobilizing slaves and freeing them in order to win them. But this is in the desperate final phases of the war. But the idea that this was a democratic movement in the broadest sense, North and South, even in the North, there's tremendous resistance to mobilizing black troops.
Yeah, Elaine, I'm curious as to where your question comes from.
Well, I'm Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
And we all know that America at that time, there were a lot of people that were from all over the world already.
Mm-hmm.
So just wondering, what was their motivation to join the military at that time?
It's a great question, yep. And I think Ed mentioned the Irish, and maybe, Ed, you could talk a little bit more about the Irish, because in some ways that is the great immigrant group of this period. And how the Irish would fit into American society, that's a live issue. There's some discussion among historians that in many ways Irish were treated as if they were black, that is, a despised other. So the moment of wartime mobilization and Irish enthusiasm for the war, North and South, because Ed's right, I mean, there are Irish units on both sides, indicates a kind of self-conscious Americanization. It's a moment in which you can prove yourself that you're part of this great country.
This is all the more remarkable that the Irish would fight, because they were often pitted against African Americans at the bottom of the social order, competing for jobs. And so the fact that Irish people, often who lived in the United States less than 10 years, are willing to imagine themselves as a part of the American people and willing to fight for the freedom of other people is really another amazing story in U.S. history.
Mm-hmm.
Something we need to remember, however, is that the Irish also rioted in the streets against what they saw as, and what was, in fact, an unfair use of the draft that seemed to them days after many of their compatriots had died in Gettysburg. And the story was in the Irish neighborhoods that they had been sacrificed by Union generals who did not value Irish lives the way they did of people who had been born in the United States. So you have both the greatest gallantry and sacrifice for the Union, but also the nagging story of when push came to shove, the Irish and other working people did actually riot against the United States.
And just for our 20th century fans, it's also true for the 20th century, where we have Zoot Suit riots among Mexican Americans during World War II, that on a large part, ethnic groups and racial groups see this as an opportunity, but they also are not unaware of the intense discrimination. And it's very understandable that some would ask, what?
But isn't it interesting, though, that the U.S. Colored troops are not rioting? I mean, there's no the
far,
draft.
Far from it.
They're rioting for the opportunity to fight. So the comparisons are interesting because, of course, there are mixed feelings about the war. But the one group that is absolutely clear about the war would be freed people or slaves, that the war means for them the end of slavery and the possibility of dignity and inclusion in the nation.
Right.
Thanks for your call. It's been a lot of fun talking
with
you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Have a good day.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks.
Bye.
We got another call, and it's a local call from right here in Charlottesville, Virginia. Blake, welcome to the show.
Hello.
So what's on your mind?
Well, you know, I was brought up in Virginia and have lived, I guess, with the Civil War for my whole life, and remember very vividly the centennial in Richmond.
Mm.
But recently I have been trying to learn a little bit about the, for lack of a better word, the causes, and have been reading particularly about the influence of the church, in this case mostly Methodist and Presbyterian churches in the South, and was wondering how you guys viewed that. Do you feel the preachers from their pulpits and their writings led the South to the Civil War, to secession?
Well, Blake, it's a great question. Blake wants to know whether the preachers are responsible for the Civil War. That's the short version of it. Obviously, they didn't do it all by themselves. I'd say this as a point of departure. Many Southerners believe there was a piety deficit between North and South, that the South was a more Christian place, and the North was riven by heresy and socialism and secularism. And so Southern preachers did a couple of important things, I think. And that is, on the one hand, to tell Southerners that they had God on their side, that they were good Christians. And second, preachers played an absolutely crucial role in the emerging pro-slavery argument.
That's really well put, Peter. I think the preachers make a real point of saying, hey, the pulpit is no place to talk about politics.
Right.
All that we say is that slavery has God's divine sanction. Mm-hmm. Other than that, we have no political position.
That's all.
That's right. So Southern preachers do not lead the South into secession, but as Peter says, as soon as Providence seems to dictate that that's the way to go, the ministers are some of the most vocal advocates of the Confederacy.
But Ed, it's my impression from historians who have written on this subject that, in fact, Southerners had ample ground in scriptural reference for the support of slavery, and they might even have had the edge over their Northern counterparts, at least if you're looking for literal readings of the Bible and what it tells us.
Well, that's the crucial point, Peter. The literal historic injunctions, especially in the Old Testament, do accept slavery as a reality. Increasingly, what happens in the North is that people look at the spirit of the New Testament instead and say, how can you possibly love someone as your brother and hold them in perpetual bondage? So there's plenty of energy in the Bible for both pro- and anti-slavery positions.
No question. But what is also going on and what's important for white Southerners is that they believe that they have been successful in a great missionary campaign to Christianize the quarters. And that's one of the reasons why they're comfortable with slavery, is that they have taken an instrumental role in spreading Christianity in the slave population. So the idea that the slaves were an internal enemy or dangerous subversives would rise up and revolt, that had been mitigated, if not altogether eliminated, for many Southerners because they thought of Christianity as a profound bond of union between black and white, even if they worship separately.
Would that be a true belief, do you think, or more or less just an apology for the burdens that they put on African Americans through slavery?
Hey, Blake, what is a true belief? It's a known unknown or unknown known known. Do they believe it? I think absolutely. One of the things that we learn as historians is to take our subject seriously. They may be, by our standards, deluded and self-serving. But that Southerners believe they were good Christians, I believe that's absolutely true.
Matter of fact, the South says we are in the process of creating the most Christian nation on the face of the earth. But your question, I think, Blake, is right. It doesn't take long for the end of the war for white Southerners to begin to worry, were we fooling ourselves?
Yeah.
You know, do they really love us? the fact that they're moving away at the very first moment of freedom really is a confrontation with a kind of truth that the white South is really not ready to embrace.
Hey, Blake, may I add an addendum to your good question?
Yes, please.
Guys, I'd like to know, I do know actually, that the church played such a crucial role in the lives of African Americans after the Civil War. Can you tell me something about religion and slaves during the Civil War?
Well, one of the first things that happens is the churches, which had been the really only interracial space in the slave South, begin separating. At the very first moment, African Americans seize the opportunity to have their own churches. You know, they've always gone off on their private worship ceremonies out in the woods or whatever. But in the Civil War itself, as things begin to fall apart, you find that black ministers step forward and begin leading the African American church. So you find that there's a kind of freedom that comes maybe first in the religious realm, and African Americans are quick to seize it.
Yeah. Well, Blake, thank you for, for calling Backstory.
Thank you, Blake.
Right.
Bye.
If you're just tuning in, this is Backstory, and today we're talking about everything you ever wanted to know about the American Civil War, or at least everything the people on the other end of our phone line want to know.
Next up on that line, we have Carl calling in from Murray, Kentucky. Carl, welcome to Backstory.
Oh, thanks. Glad to be on.
Yeah, so we're talking about the Civil War, and you have something for us.
My question involves education. Uh-huh. As a future educator myself.
Right.
Just wondering, what do y'all see the significance of the Civil War for kids of the next generation?
Yeah, super question. That's really the big question of this series we're doing on the Civil War. What can we take away from the Civil War? What are the lessons we want to learn? And can we get beyond simply reveling in the details and reenactments and all that stuff? How about the 20th century?
Because,
you know, Carl's an educator.
I was being quiet because I know so little about the Civil War, Carl, but I'll say my piece and then shut up. I'll tell you what I've learned from the guys about the Civil War, which is basically you don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. You know, there were some very smart people back then, and we might not have agreed with them and their views, but they thought about this really carefully, and they followed the news, and they talked to each other, and they debated each other. And just about everything that they thought was going to happen either didn't happen or happened in another way or happened in ways that absolutely would have confounded them two or three years later.
Brian, that is so absolutely right, and it's the historian's takeaway. But just imagine with Carl that we got school kids, and we want this to be a real teaching opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
Are there any, the old-fashioned word civics, any civics lessons, Ed and Brian?
Well, I'll continue and then, again, try to shut up.
You'll succeed.
I think one of the lessons I would take away, Carl, and your future students, is that language and the way we talk to each other matters.
Right.
That's a very timely issue today, as you know. And we as historians tend to poo-poo some of this very heated rhetoric that's being tossed around today and say, oh, you know, they were a lot worse to each other back in the 19th century. But you know what? Every now and then, things kind of come unraveled.
Right.
And that heated rhetoric, which they surely used, contributed, I think, to tearing at the fabric of the nation, along with, of course, key issues like slavery and expansion of slavery into the territories. And now I really am going to be quiet.
May I ask what age students that you'll be teaching, Carl?
It'll be secondary ed.
Okay.
Eighth to 12th grade.
Oh, man, eighth. If I were you, I would choose the 12th.
Hey, I'm at the point now, I'll take anything they give me, really.
I know how that goes. That's right, even eighth graders. Well, you know, it's a fine line. I always tell the story. I've actually written some things about kind of the open-ended nature of some of these things. And my daughter, who was 11 at the time, which I guess is pretty close to, that's not quite eighth grade.
Right.
She's very precocious, though, Carl.
Exactly. So she walked in literally with her American history textbook with her finger in the part of the pages. And she said, Daddy, what caused the Civil War? And I was thinking, okay, right. Do I go into this all this thing about the complexity and the indeterminacy and the choices to be made? And I said, slavery, honey.
And,
you know, because, you know, that's what she could have right then. That's what she could understand.
Yeah.
If you have to choose one word, that's what it is.
Right.
But the trick is, you know, as the kids get older, to suggest, yes, it was slavery, but how was it slavery?
Yeah,
does
that's
this suggest that the North was all different from the
right.
South? No, they weren't. They sort of discovered over the course of the war that slavery was going to have to be destroyed, and they didn't want to do it necessarily, and they weren't just the good guys who were coming in.
Right.
But the people that, you know, look back on now and, you know, you have the same accent I do, so I know you're a fellow Southerner.
God, it's really grating, isn't it, Brian?
Yeah.
I love the way
I would say one's enough.
Hey, it's never enough, is it, Carl?
That's right. That's right. But you do together, I guess.
Well, we tried that once. It didn't really work out all that well. Even the last time I checked, you guys in Kentucky chose not to stand together with the South.
Come on, East Tennessee.
I was going to say, I'm from far western Kentucky, and we were called the South Carolina Kentucky, so I guess
I'm from East Tennessee, and we're called the Massachusetts of Tennessee, so I guess it all evens out, which is an important lesson in and of itself, you know, that this was not just a thing. If I were to come up with a sort of a short version of all of this, is that, kids, this is a story that we have to follow to see how it unfolds. You can't just sort of get to the summary and say that's what it was all about.
You know what? We have to be aware of unintended consequences. And we like, in our mythic understandings of American history, to ascribe the right intentions to our forefathers and foremothers. We like to think that the right people at the right time stood up, like Abraham Lincoln represents the North, and he had a vision that slavery was evil.
Right.
It's not that there isn't a conscience and a moral sense. There is all over the place. It's just that what happened was not scripted. That it became a war that ended slavery was on nobody's mind, or very few, except for radical abolitionist minds at the start of the war. And I think this is humbling.
Right.
So, Carl, after listening to all this, do you still want to go into the history teaching biz?
Well, yeah, all right.
Okay, so what can we do to get you a job now, Carl? Let's get down to brass tacks.
How about it? We write a letter for him.
We're ready.
All right. Backstory endorses Carl. Great talking with you, Carl. Thanks for calling.
Oh, yeah, I really enjoyed it.
Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, Carl.
Thank you.
It's time for another break. Don't go away, though. When we get back, we'll hear if these two very wordy colleagues of mine are capable of summing up the Civil War in 140 characters. That's right. You're going to hear Peter and Ed tweet the Civil War.
You're listening to a Civil War special from Backstory, and we'll be back in a minute.